That one throw you had to Jeff, I know there were a bunch of them, but one, it looked like it might sail over his head, and he just elevated to a different level. Did you think he had it the whole way?
I totally thought he misread that. Then I told him I should never doubt you, Jeff.
Welcome back. We have the big news broken earlier today. Jeff Babbitt is shipping up to Boston. The Glory have announced the signing of last season's MVP for the 2024 season. That is a huge get for a Boston team coming off of their first ever playoff appearance as a franchise. Hi, everyone. I'm Adam Ruffner. That is Cameron Brock. We are now in the midst of a quasi-emergency pod. I know we jumped on the end of last week talking about the official news that Jeff Babbitt did not re-sign with the reigning champion New York Empire and that he would be on the move. We're back here a little bit earlier than scheduled to confirm that news and go over some of the effects of what will now be considered, I think, one of the more pivotal signings in this league's history. Obviously, we talked about it last week and in the pod before that, about the potential of Babbitt's move, the impacts it would have for both New York as well as the competitors around the league. Cam, what are your first thoughts as you now see Babbitt in Boston? You know, the Glory were pretty decidedly the third place team in that division last year. Does this move them into true contender territory, or what does this kind of news mean both for Boston, the East Division, New York, league at large? Take your pick.
We'll get to this more as we go through the rest of this episode, but I'll go ahead and just say this right now. I think if I had to give a percentage breakdown right now of odds of teams to make it to championship weekend out of the East, I only have three teams I would even give a percentage to. I think this clearly puts Boston ahead of Philly. But I would put it at like 45% New York, maybe. Like before, I felt pretty, I was way over 50%. I think knowing Babbitt's gone, maybe 45%, and then like 30%.
Wait. Before Babbitt was gone, the two-time reigning East Division champion, three of the last four New York Empire, you only had just slightly above 50%.
No. I'm saying I had them above, well above 50% before.
Like 80 to 90%.
Yeah. It was like 95%.
Okay. When you say like well above, I'm almost still thinking like low 70s. Like that's still
no. Like it was probably like at 95% New York.
Okay.
If Babbitt's still there.
Just wanted to get these approximate hypothetical, totally made up off your dome numbers.
I'm going 45, 30, 25. How about that?
Okay.
That's my breakdown. 45% New York, 30% DC,
25% Boston. So what is that up from before Babbitt signing?
2%.
Were they even on the map, or was it just kind of
2%,
like...
2% maybe.
Okay. Snowball's chance in hell officially for that. And now all the way up to like kind of contentious. Like I would put my odds on a playoff team getting a 25% chance to make it to championship weekend. I mean, those are considerable odds.
And we're going to talk about why as we get, like, probably as we discuss this more, but like, I think a fairly strong argument for this, but I'll let the people decide.
Well, I mean, this is a big get for a Boston team that I think showed a lot of spark last year. Obviously, they made the playoffs. They kind of vanquished the other challenger for that spot in the East in the Philadelphia Phoenix, who kind of stand to be one of the biggest sets of losers from this signing announcement. You know, not only obviously New York for losing Babbitt specifically, but also Philly, because like you were saying, it felt like they were kind of getting together another revenge tour after not getting into the playoffs last year, after they'd made their, they had summited a 10-year hiatus in 2022. Mm-hmm. The Phoenix always announcing their kind of superiority on social media. And now with Babbitt moving to ostensibly their closest rival in Boston, a Glory team that swept the season series last year against the Phoenix 2-0, now it's like, man, it just feels like Boston leveled up and Phoenix stand to be better. They're a young team on an upward curve of improvement. Mm-hmm. But they didn't have an MVP this offseason. I mean, their kind of trajectory is pointing upward. They got arrow up, but they don't have a Babbitt. And this is a kind of addition that just gives Boston, I think, a punching level that they frankly never had. I mean, obviously they've had some pretty substantial athletes pass through. Orion Cable has been a dominant force for them the past couple of seasons. Ben Sadok, Ray Tetro, you know, these are players that can take over for stretches, but nothing like Babbitt. And particularly for a Boston team that struggled scoring the disc of the past couple of seasons, especially last year, they had two games that were shortened due to weather. It noticeably 8-5 loss to New York early in the season that had the entire back half of the game postponed due to inclement weather. Mm-hmm. They were the fifth worst scoring team in the UFA last year. Even if you throw out that half game result, they only bump up two spots and they're still underneath 19 goals a game. Now they add in the leading goal scorer over the past two seasons in Jeff Babbitt. It gives their offense, again, just a surefire target now to go alongside some other greats in Simon Carapella, last year's Rookie of the Year finalists. He finished behind Lucas Ambrose and Walker Frankenberg, as well as Tanner Johnson-Goh, who's returning to the team. He's a huge playmaker for them. You know, they just have, I think, a good amount of offensive versatility. They go about 10 deep on that side of the disc. What do you like about Boston adding a receiver and a playmaker like Babbitt, aside from the superlatives and the way that we've talked about him on the show for you know, many, many episodes? What other than those qualities does he specifically add to this Glory lineup?
I mean, he's going to be the best cutter on offense and the best defender on that entire team. I mean, And you would say that pretty much for any team he would join, right? This isn't like a knock on Boston. He was the MVP for a reason. I think the only person in the league who scored more goals than me over the last two seasons is Jeff Babbitt, actually. So here's the thing. I also like Rocco Linehan. I like Brendan McCann. Like, I like those guys too. Mm-hmm.
I feel like they found a little bit more of a role on defense. Both of them are fantastic with the disc, and I really like when they have a high volume role in whatever setup they're in. But I feel like in Boston's lineups, they've really found purchase leading the defensive attack and kind of using their athleticism.
And that's what I like about them is, like, I think, like you said, offensively they struggled, but I like what they have on defense already.
Gotcha.
But pre-Babbitt. So, like, adding somebody who's going to bolster the side of the disc where you're weak, and he's immediately going to make you better. Like, I don't know how high they jump offensively with Jeff on the team, but, I mean, you would think that they would be able to at least be middling and not be stuck in the basement of the UFA when it comes to scoring. The other thing, he's not going to throw the disc away. Like, that's the other thing we know about him. He's not like a guy who's going to come in and put up a bunch of scores, but also like bring the turnovers with him. Like, he's going to be maybe the most efficient person on that offensive line as well. He just brings so many good things. He comes from a championship mentality. He's won three UFA titles. And he is going to be bringing that experience with him. He's from, like, he went to UMass. So he's kind of like coming home, you know, going to Boston. And I am just really, I'm really excited for Boston because last year was the first year where it felt like they bought in to the UFA. Like, their players were, most of their players who were important to their success were there week in, week out with very few absences. You know, the most dynamic receiver they had was Orion Cable, but he was never there for more than about half of a season in any season that he played in. So now they're getting someone who we know is going to be there week in, week out. He's going to be an absolute monster and just impossible for defenses to deal with. And, I mean, what's not to like about this move? Like, I'm really excited. I think this makes the East so much more interesting. You know, as much as I...
It was already interesting. Yeah, I mean, now you're shifting an MVP piece to a borderline playoff team, I would say. I wouldn't say that their, like, spot was confirmed this year.
Correct.
So.
I think it was semi-interesting. I mean, it was interesting only in as much as Philly likes to talk a lot and sometimes play a good game every once in a while but never actually win. And there's the eternal, is DC going to win question, which the answer was always no. So now I think it's truly interesting because now I think DC truly does have a chance to win those games. I think Boston really does have a potential chance to, like, do something and go potentially to championship weekend. I still favor New York. I think until the king is dethroned, they're still the Kings. But I mean, I like this a lot. I think it makes the playoff race a lot less interesting. Like, there was kind of the, is it going to be Philly? Is it going to be Boston? And until like the second to last week when Boston beat Philly and really kind of sealed their playoff spot, it was kind of interesting to see that play out. But I don't think we're going to have that drama this year.
I totally disagree, man. I think that this just makes everything more of a melee. I think it reestablishes a little bit what the undercard is and displaces a little bit more of what DC and New York have been at the top. I mean, this has been a division that I think, maybe to your point about the East becoming more interesting, it's sort of been, in an abstract way, if you squint, it's kind of contentious, but really it's DC and New York up here and Philly, Boston, Montreal, and Toronto down here, right? Like, there are have and have nots on the Eastern border. And now with this movement, it feels just more like a jambalaya. Like, there's a little bit more just mix, right? Like, I don't know that it eliminates Philly entirely. Like, I definitely think that Phoenix will use this for coal in their engine, as they kind of always do, no matter what comes their way. But
hey,
that this makes anything less interesting about the third seed. I just think it gives more expectations to a Boston team who, to kind of your point, has never shown a sense of consistency. So yeah, they get Babbitt, but along with it, a heap more of expectations that they've really never had since maybe the like second week of their team's existence in 2021, when they were coming off a big win at Pittsburgh and seemed like they were maybe going to take a game against Atlanta at home before the hustle kind of rallied in the second half. I mean, I don't know.
Let me give you two reasons why I really think this closes the door on Philly. The first being that last year was the first year that Boston really bought in, like that their roster bought in. And they all bought in. And even with basically no real full season experience, they went through the season and got the third seed. And now those players are coming back, I'm assuming are taking it just as seriously again and are going to be there week in and week out. So they're going to have that full season of experience under their belt where they already made the playoffs. Now they're coming back with that core and adding arguably the best player in the league. I don't see how Philly overcomes that. Like, I feel like they're going to jump up exponentially this year because of the buy-in from last year that's carrying on over to this year. I think that puts whereas Philly, like, they're running back mostly the same roster they've had for 3 years now. And we have seen the inconsistency for the last 2 years. And there, until I see it not be that way this year, I'm assuming they're going to be inconsistent Philly again this year. There's nothing that tells me that they're going to be on an upswing necessarily. If there's one thing, it's that Tricolini is he only has 1 year under his belt. He's coming back for a second year. He was phenomenal in his first year. So maybe that's one place I would look to is, like, here's a place where this person was great last year, and maybe with a year under their belt, they're actually going to be even better this year. But outside of that, like, I feel like we've kind of seen some of these players are already kind of in their prime. I don't see them necessarily, like Sean Mott, I'm not sure he's getting any better at this point. If anything, maybe he's about the same he's been, which is great. But we're talking about having to overcome someone ahead of you. That means we need to be getting better. Now, I listened to James Pollard on the Breakside podcast, and he did say one thing he's looking for, like trying to do this year, is complete more of his passes. Like, that is something that's on his mind. I think if he can do that and make a jump forward in his completion percentage and his decision making, that's probably the single biggest thing that can help Philly be better this year, because he's got a lot of margin to work with there. So, I mean, for him, that probably looks like throwing 1.5 less turns a game. So I don't know. That's where I'm at.
Yeah, I mean, that is a mouthful for Philly team that you both kind of like, but are now hedging a bit. I don't know where you are right now at Philly. It just kind of seems like you were ready to take a jump off point of solidifying, closing the door on their playoff stuff. And then kind of towards the end there, it sounded a little bit more of like, well, if James Pollard plays well, they're going to be a pretty good team. So
I still don't think they're going to have.
You might have to like hammer that one out a little bit more, put it back in the oven. I don't know. Like,
here's here's Philly's range. Their range of where they can play at doesn't even fit on my screen.
No, I mean, that's true. And I think Boston might similarly be a team like that this year, depending on how Babbitt performs in any given matchup. I mean, it's not so much how impactful it will be. It will be, can Boston, I think, get him the disc enough? One of the things I think that was kind of underrated was how good New York's system was in making it look so easy to go A to B to Babbitt, right? Like, their sort of direct connection and ability to clear out and let the big men go to work was sort of second to none. And now obviously that's made so much easier with their level of talent. But I think it remains to reason that Boston will have to develop similar sorts of systems and routes so that Babbitt can kind of play the game that he enjoys. Again, this isn't a player who necessarily just clears out and goes deep. He's a small spaces operator that requires a lot more technical skill, timing, just knowing your teammates, which is going to be something Jeff is now going to have to hit the ground running in order to catch up with kind of a delayed preseason. You know, we're now just over 3 weeks out from the start, the 2024 calendar. Like, there's a lot of different factors, I think, going into this edition beyond just Babbitt good, he score goal, he make play. Like, I know that there is just kind of a rock simple solution to all of this. Of just, they added the MVP, shut up and enjoy it. It's like that meme of the two guys looking out the different windows of the bus.
Like
frowning out the one side and the other one smiling. It's like, just shut up and enjoy the Babbitt signing is the smiling side. And I definitely, I feel that way about this signing. And so I wanted to kind of get into maybe more of the details about where Boston is now headed. And sure. Specifically, what do their first five games look like heading into their slate of schedule? And what's really interesting is that the Glory will face all five other East Division contenders in their first five matchups, and all before May 17th.
Yeah.
So a really front-loaded Glory schedule is going to reveal kind of what they are even before we hit Memorial Day. And I think that that's going to really kind of set up the rest of how this division will go, both for Boston and for, again, those other five teams. So in order, they start their season hosting Montreal, then Toronto, and then they have a road doubleheader on the third weekend of games. On May 10th, they're at DC. On May 11th, they're at Philly. And then the following weekend, their first meeting with New York at home. That's going to be, I think, in the realm of like must watch game of the year sort of thing, just to see, right? You gotta see what it looks like to see Babbitt in a different jersey going against his former team, and he's never played for anyone else in this league.
Can we just take stock for a second that Boston will be playing their fourth game on the day that the Alley Cats will be playing their first game?
I mean, the U of A schedule do be crazy like that. Yeah. Like it is like that in this league at times. I mean, you can attest probably better than anyone having played. Are you the also number one in games played at this point? I think you are.
Games played, points played, assists.
you know the record.
Goals, scores. I'm coming up on 300 assists. You better watch out.
How was that like 600, man? You're not catching that one. Much like it's going to take someone some real work to get to your goal scoring number. I don't know if you can catch
up. Founder of the 600-300 club. Let's go. All right. So the thing that's crazy about that schedule, right, is first off, you get the whole, like, they've literally played every team in the division by week four of the season, which is pretty cool because, like you said, it can give us some information. I mean, if there's anything, it's going to be telling about how they might end up in the playoff shuffle. I mean, first five games, you play everyone in your division once, you know, you're going to be either up 1-0 or down 1-0, down 0-1 in every single matchup, right? So you mentioned they start off with Montreal. Like, Montreal clearly was the weakest team in that division last year. We expect them to be better. I still expect them to be a bottom two team in the division because, until I see otherwise, I mean, we're talking about a team that didn't win a game last year. So that's kind of the ideal start. Like you said, he's got this preseason that's really cut short. I mean, we're less than a month out from opening poll. So not a lot of time to work with. We don't know how many practices he's going to be able to get in. before they actually suit up for that first game. But then Toronto, who, as you mentioned last week, we had missed on the roster announcement some big names that weren't coming back. So Toronto's probably looking to take a dip this year as far as things stand. So you're starting off with two games where maybe like this is where we can get the kinks worked out. Maybe this is where we can see what this is going to look like. And, you know, as much as I just talked about how I do favor them heavily over Philly at this point, the fact that their first time playing Philly is going to be on the second day of a back-to-back, I mean, that's advantage Philly, right? Like, we saw Philly pick off a Carolina team last year at home in the same situation where they had won the big game in D.C. the night before, but then they go up to Philly the next day and lose. And so can Philly take advantage of a team that's going to be playing on day two and thus put the pressure on Boston on that second matchup? That'll be really interesting, but we'll know just 3 weeks in, right? 3 weeks in, they'll have four games played already, and I think we'll start to get a sense of what's going to happen with this team. But you're absolutely right. Everything's going to be focused on that fifth game when Jeff Babbitt plays against New York. And I am really curious to see who they have matching up on him. I think conventional wisdom, we all think Bignot, like you need somebody who might be able to contend in the air. Although there was the quote from Bignot, which was, that was posted today.
I was going to say, I need to bring it up. So yeah. There was, I don't know if it was on a recent episode or if they were just asking on a previous thing, but the Pod Practice podcast, which is run by the Colorado Summit trio of head coach Mikey Lunn, Alex Atkins, and Quinn Finer, the two star players for the Summit. If you haven't checked out their podcast, please do. It's a great player and coach run piece of media. They get fantastic interviews all of the time, and they had Yacht on there, and he was talking about going up against Babbitt in practice in 1v1 jump balls. And Yacht said, without any mincing of his words, that other than one or two times, Babbitt has basically beaten him every single time. And Yacht considers himself to be kind of unreproachable against almost anyone else. And against Babbitt, he just cannot gain an edge. And not only that, he was saying that Babbitt is so underrated for his speed. And while people think Antoine Davis is rightfully considered a track star at times in this game, Babbitt can claim to be faster in a foot race. So it's one of those things where Jeff's physical tools, I think, still continue to be kind of underrated until you get in that one-on-one space and have to deal with the combination of side speed and just field IQ that he has. There's that alchemy that happens, I think, so often in sports where it's easy to look at certain characteristics, certain physical, I think, traits and assess what somebody is going to be. But Babbitt is somebody who, again, you stand next to him and he's just under like 6'1". People always think of him as this really larger than life person. He just asserts himself that way in the field through using all of his tools. And it'll be really interesting to see what he does against his former team. And I think obviously you think again of the kind of like dream matchup of going up against Yacht, but maybe that isn't the solution. And maybe it is almost that they know that they don't have an individual matchup that they can solve for him. And particularly if it's a motivated Babbitt playing in kind of a rivalry matchup against his former team. So maybe they just kind of let him go get his and focus on strategy elsewhere. I don't know. We're going to have a lot to chew on as we get to preview that matchup in a few weeks. But I wanted to get to some other news too, because while New York obviously is going to be dealing with the immense loss of the former MVP, their former team captain, and a pillar to their organization, the Empire did make some news at the end of last week by announcing the signing of last year's All-UFA rookie team member and a standout international player, Liam Haberfield, who was one of the more dynamic offensive players in the league last year. He started in just 8 games, but in those 8 performances for the Hustle, he managed 2.25 assists, 1.6 goals, 24 completions at a 97% clip, over 300 total yards, almost a huck per game at a 75% clip from deep. I mean, this guy has a full toolkit. And I think what really leads the assessment of Haberfield is that like game-changing flick hook that he has. I mean, he came out the box with that thing in his debut against Carolina last year. And other than Nethercutt, I don't know that I've seen a more aesthetically pleasing just rocket arm from range than Haverfield. I mean, when he gets that rock step into it and just kind of lets heave ho, that thing is 65 yards out of hand on the run. Like it's a kind of game-changing throw, and then you throw it into a lineup, a New York offense that already features Ryan Osgard, former MVP, ostensibly Ben Yacht coming back on offense, former MVP, Jack Williams, Charles Weinberg. You know, this is kind of a player who feels almost ready-made to adapt to a New York system that, while they're losing an MVP, they can kind of afford to plug and play a bit, and Haverfield is more than capable of stepping up and contributing like a star.
Yeah, and actually his debut was against the Indianapolis Alley Cats. We actually played against him last year, first game of the season.
I thought he debuted against Carolina. Did he just have a really quiet game against you guys or something?
He played 15 points. He had a couple of assists. I remember watching him in warmups and just seeing the throwing mechanics you were talking about. But yeah, it was his first game and it was a blowout. So like, it wasn't like there was much to report on. But yeah, we played against him.
I totally forgot that game. Yeah, because
the game was very forgettable.
He had over 500 total yards. I mean, he still has 43 completions against you guys. I don't know why I just brain farted on that performance. I guess the next game against Carolina, he had 8 total scores, 500 total yards, and was just like a highlight machine. But he was kind of, I think, in the backfield a lot for your game and just was kind of like making a pro debut, didn't want to make too many mistakes, just sort of completing passes.
Yeah, he was like 43 of 44 completions against us. A lot of swinging the disc. Nothing super crazy. I mean, he was only averaging, less than 5 yards of completion. So, like, clearly there wasn't a lot of, like, big throwing going on. But, yeah, I mean, he's a difference maker. Like, I don't know how he slots in on New York. Like, I don't know if he ends up playing offense for them. I don't know how many games he's playing. Like you said, he played, I think, 8 games last year for Atlanta. So he wasn't available every single week. One thing we know about the Empire over the time that they've been so dominant is that their roster consistency is so high. So when you're talking about a team that really loves to send the same 20 guys out there week in, week out, is he going to do that? Is he going to be there all 12 games? Is he going to be someone who...
Yeah, no. So I can actually add in here. I have heard that he is deeply committed to this team and that this is actually a part of like a multi-year contract and also visa program, because again, he is a foreign player from Australia. He was a rookie last year, but I believe he turns 30 either this year or next. But yeah, this is a longer term commitment. So I think that they're kind of putting him in a more pillar position, which of course there's a whole can of worms to discuss if somebody wants to, about how maybe Haverfield got into this position and Babbitt got let go of, but I don't know the beginning of contracts in this league.
Sure.
So we can just kind of acknowledge that elephant in the room and then turn away from it. And back to the fact that I think that, you know, again, there's sort of been this now noise and fury around, well, New York is looking different. They lost Babbitt. They lost Lithiau. They lost some of their other back-end players that have been so important to this 30-game winning streak and back-to-back titles. Is New York going to be worse this year? Are they mortal? We kind of said the same thing last year with the official news that Babbitt wouldn't be re-upping with them. And yet, you look at this team offensively, defensively. They go 8, 9, 10 deep on both lines. They've still got 3 to 5 players who could possibly contend for the MVP this year. I know we kind of talked about maybe choosing the field end of last week when we were on this podcast, if we were to choose the 2024 title pick. Even after this confirmation of Babbitt going to Boston, I'm kind of in my logical heart going more back towards New York as the favorite going into 2024, man. Like, you know what this team is going to bring as far as discipline and commitment. The talent is no question. I still think that maybe their schedule and the advantageousness of it will get to them. Last year it didn't. Maybe it will this year. You know, they've got to play Salt Lake. They've They've got to play Minnesota. They've got some tasks ahead of them. This team is a war machine, man. And they've shown again and again that when they take challenges, they take them more seriously than any other franchise in this league. You add in Haberfield, you give them a little bit of a new thing, a new motivation to chew on. This is such a team that finds new ways to keep that fire going. Now they've got the shadow of the Colossus of losing Babbitt. Is this New York team maybe just as scary as it's ever been, and we're all going to discredit it because Babbitt's leaving? And while that's monumental, there are ways in which things move forward, teams come back together. I'm spitballing now. I want to hear from you.
Ooh, man. Okay, hold on. You ready for this?
I'm ready.
Right now, the NCAA tournament is going on. Yeah? Mm-hmm. In fact, women's games are going on right now. Right now, LSU and Iowa are playing.
That's the battle for this nation. Sorry, we got to wrap this up soon so we can both go watch that.
So, but let's talk about the tournament as a whole. There is one phrase that somebody can tell me about their favorite team going into the NCAA tournament that I always have the same reaction to. If somebody tells me, yeah, my team, they roll 10 deep. They're looking good going into the tournament. My first thought is, you already lost. Because you know why? The NCAA tournament isn't about depth. It's not about going 10 deep on your rotation. It's about going 6 deep, 7 deep. It's about the best talent on the field. It's not about those back-end players. We made this mistake as analysts at Championship Weekend 2022. Me, Ian Toner, Daryl Stanley all predicted Carolina to beat New York. And we basically all had the same reasoning, which I don't think anyone would disagree with us. If you looked at Carolina's roster, 1 through 20, they had the best 1 through 20. Maybe they didn't have the best 1 through 7, 1 through 10, but that back half, that 11 through 20, we would have taken their 11 through 20 over anyone's. And I don't think anyone would have disagreed with us.
No, I mean, Daniel Cohen and I in this year's show said the exact same thing for numerous weeks. Look at this depth. Look at the amount of tools that they have. Look at the flexibility of rotations. The lineups, Cameron, the lineups.
Right. And you know what? You know what we found out? It was the same thing we should have already known. 11 through 20 don't matter. They just don't. Mm-hmm. 11 through 20 on your roster. I'm sorry, people who are 11 through 20 on your roster. But like when it comes to winning time, when it comes to winning important games, 1 through 10 matter. 1 through 10, that's whoever's got the better 1 through 10, that's who's going to win the game. And I think we just saw how much that mattered in Championship Weekend 2022 when the New York Empire demolished the competition. And it just wasn't even close. The games fell over really early, even at moments where you kind of thought Chicago or Carolina might have had a little spark. It was just extinguished so quickly. You're taking a guy who is obviously going to be in anyone's top 10. I mean, top 3 or 4 on your roster at minimum. That's a big deal. Like, that matters so much more than like talking to me about New York's depth. Like, it really does, because what you're taking away this, you're taking away this dominant force. Who, the other thing is how many points he's out there for, right? Like, you talk about somebody who's 15 through 20 in the lineup, how many points are they playing in a game? Maybe 6, 7? I don't know. Like, we're talking about somebody who's going to be out there for 20 plus points. And like that makes such a huge difference. So Liam Haberfield is great.
I wanted to add to your point, because I was thinking about the first matchup between DC and New York last year in week 3, and that second half when DC started to play in a way that I don't think we've seen too often, which is that they started to go highlight for highlight with New York. It was sort of New York would make a big play, then it would be Ben Ord or Johnny Malks, mm-hmm, or Christian Boxley responding downfield. They kind of had this punch and counter with the Empire that a lot of times they just didn't have the firepower for in the past. And then what was the turning point in that game? What was the moment? We all know it. It was Babbitt blitzing through what was essentially double coverage to get to the spot first at the front cone, mm-hmm, and then bellowing, "That's my effing cone," so that everyone within the vicinity, I mean, it was like the
I heard it in Indy.
It was the Colossus scream from X-Men when he's like, ah, and it like ruptures around him. Like, that's what Babbitt did in that moment. He claimed the game for New York. And that was the thing that their Avengers squad kind of always did, right? Like, it was like, if it wasn't one, it was somebody else. And they had a response for you every time. And I hear you there, like, they just lost one of their responders. And while Haberfield is fantastic, we don't know that he's going to be the person to respond in the fourth quarter and shout down the opponent and let everyone know what time it is. Like, that's just a different beast. And I think that's always what's been apparent since Babbitt stepped foot into this league, right? He's just that dude. He's
that dude.
To start saying a whole bunch of cliches, like, he's that guy. Like, he's him. Like, he is him.
All right, this is the part where we say, April Fools, he's not going. No, I'm just kidding. He really is going to
Boston. Dang it,
The amount of texts I've gotten today.
I will edit you out. Like,
seriously, the amount of texts I've gotten, the amount of Discord messages where people are like, is this real? like so many
I know. It's one of those things where it's always been, from my understanding, on Jeff Babbitt's timeline. Like, he's been intensely, this has been an intensely personal decision. It's kind of been along a rushed set of circumstances. We've only been receiving the news kind of on a need-to-know basis and basically a few hours before any given announcement. We didn't even know it was Boston until midway through yesterday, Sunday. We're recording this on Monday.
We had a feeling, but yeah, we didn't know.
We had a feeling because he's from the Boston area, went to UMass.
It made sense.
Is kind of representative of that area. But I have thought he still might work something out with New York, that maybe something would transpire over the weekend and he would just end up going back. Like,
but
here we are.
The thing we're not talking about, like, too, is like
25 days out.
Do you, and I kind of, you know, on a related note, like we talked about, there's some other people, like Ben Katz isn't coming back that we know of yet. And like, he, you know, he doesn't fit into the same tier of player, right, that we're talking about with Babbitt. But like, I'm also wondering, They've been having this two coach system for the last few seasons, right? Like, I'm really interested.
You wanna get into the intangible argument of this? That's, I think, where it really becomes interesting, because
we're talking about personnel that's really been really crucial to the team, but now also coaching, right? Like, Anthony Nunez and Charlie Hoppus just seemed like the perfect duo of coaches. They worked so well together. Like, those guys,
they were the Ted Lasso guys. They were Ted Lasso and who's his helper, assistant? Don't they just call him like Coach Beard? Yeah, I mean, they had that kind of dynamic where the one would step up, the other would kind of know to support, and then they would switch. They were perfect in that kind of co-coaching role.
Yeah, and I'm just kind of, I mean, that's something that we're probably not going to be able to know as much, but that's clearly going to have an effect. I mean, you have half as much manpower going into the coaching.
Babbitt was often a coach in the huddles. Yep. I mean, I could go back and pull you tons of literal camera footage from their home games where it's Babbitt standing in the middle and talking strategy to whoever's about to go on the field, even if he isn't in the lineup. So it's kind of like losing, again, another defensive coordinator, coach, manager on the sideline, and Babbitt to go along with Hoppus.
I think, yeah, so like, they just lost so much. Like, even though you look at the losses on the roster, you're not going to see a huge difference. I feel like there was like a lot of loss that happened. So I don't know how much this ends up playing into the season. None of us really do. All we can do is, we're in that fun part of the year where all we can do is speculate, but it's going to have some sort of effect. I just don't know what that is yet.
I mean, I think it's establishing a whole host of new rivalries, right? Like, I just think this makes, again, New York vulnerable in a way in which people are going to come that much harder. I feel like there's a little bit of a malaise happening. And I think you even saw it last year at championship weekend. There was just sort of the notion of New York after they sort of demolished Carolina and Chicago in 2022, when they were playing close in the middle of those games. in 2023 at Championship Weekend, it was just sort of an open slaughter from the midway point of the first quarter onward in both the semifinals and the finals against Austin and Salt Lake. And I think that, you know, from talking with players at the immediacy heading into the offseason, there was kind of like a fatigue. It was sort of like, we got to go up against that again. We got to go climb up Everest again and have an ogre toss us off the top of the mountain. Like, seriously, I mean, that's what it was. That you run down the field and it's Jeff Babbitt, Ben Yacht, and the rest of the, again, Avengers squad facing and breathing down your neck. They're down a couple of those. They lose a little bit of the intimidation. I think stuff like that makes a big difference in sports. I think that it truly does. And so I just think you're going to see that closing of the margin, meaning that so many more teams get their taste, get their shot at taking down Goliath.
How exciting is this? Like, I know some people would complain. They'd be like, oh, like some people would be like, oh, this Empire team, they're like ruining the league. Like, no, no, no. You know what people love? Somebody to root against. Like, you want to know who gets ratings? The New York Yankees in the 90s and early 2000s, who were just like winning everything. Guess who was watching every World Series the Yankees were playing in? Everyone who loved the Yankees and the rest of the nation who hated, who just wanted to see them lose, right? Like, they talk about this, to go back to the NCAA tournament, the upsets are fun in the early rounds, but they have a lot of metrics that show that viewership goes down as you get further into the tournament when the blue bloods aren't in it, when the Dukes, the Kentuckys, the Kansases, like when those teams aren't in it late, people stop watching because everyone either loves to root for or root against those teams. And that's kind of what New York's become. You either love to see the greatness or you're just waiting for a team to knock them off the top. And this just makes them seem human. They seem mortal at this point, having lost a little bit of what they had last year. And so, like, I think every New York matchup just becomes so much more, like, almost like must-watch TV, like, because now it's not, are they going to falter? It almost feels like an inevitability. Like, they're going to lose a game this year. Like, I don't know how many games they lose, but it feels like it's definitely happening. And when is it going to happen? I don't know. But it feels like much more of a thing that I'm expecting to happen instead of a thing that could happen at this point.
Yeah, to kind of extend what you were saying a moment ago about people love to watch a winner. I mean, what other series in the NBA Finals over the last decade or so has come even close to Cavaliers versus Warriors? And then you talk about the NFL. I mean, it's either been Patriots and Tom Brady winning, or teams defining themselves by beating the Patriots, or the newer era of Mahomes, which is kind of becoming in the same mold as Brady, which is either you get Mahomes sort of summiting his throne again, or somebody making a valiant run against him, which is all the more tantalizing. Mm-hmm. And of course, we will be talking about similar such things on this year's show as we continue to march closer and closer to April 26th. Again, I kind of muttered it a little bit ago, but that is 25 days away now, 24 probably by the time you're listening to this. We're really getting close here to the start of a new UFA season. And though we're a bit more dormant and longer than we usually are, it's eaten up quicker than it ever has.
Yeah.
Cam and I will be back with you next week to talk even more about it. We'll take off for now. Talk to you soon. Bye now.